in the City of Reno versus Jody E. Turbidity, case number 73971. Is counsel for the appellant ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please let the clerk know how much time you want to reserve for rebuttal and approach that.
Thank you. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. I'd like to start by thanking you for the opportunity to argue this case. As you know, this appeal involves the statutory cap on lump sum PPD awards. In particular, this case involves a dispute over whether the claimant's 33% permanent partial disability award gets paid 25% in lump sum with 8% in installments versus 18% in lump sum and 15% in installments. The dispute is significant because it comes up any time there are multiple PPD awards that total more than 25% total. This case in and of itself is not all that significant dollar-wise, but it's an issue that does come up with some frequency. I'd like to start by discussing several fundamental concepts underlying PPD awards. And I'd like to do that because I think it's important to understand those concepts in order to understand how the legislature intended the statutory cap to apply. So what's a PPD award? What's it for? Why do we pay them? The theory is that when an industrial injury causes permanent impairment, it causes permanent loss in earning capacity. The greater the impairment, the greater the loss in earning capacity. PPD awards are paid to compensate for that loss in earning capacity over the lifetime of the claimant. So how do we calculate that impairment where there are multiple injuries causing multiple different impairments? The statute that provides for PPD awards, 616C.490, tells us what you do. And specifically, it says in subsection 9 that when you calculate a PPD, you take all prior impairments. I think some of the language indicates loss of a hand, loss of a foot, loss of an eye, into account when you calculate the PPD. You total the total PPD impairments, and then you deduct out the pre-existing or previous impairments when you actually consider how much gets paid for the particular industrial injury. The point that's important there is that PPD awards are always looked at from a whole person perspective. In other words, anytime you do a PPD, you're supposed to take into account previous PPD awards, combine them under the combined values chart that's set up in the AMA guides, and come up with a total impairment. And that concept is important and underlies some of the reasons why we believe the claimant's approach to the statutory cap here is incorrect. So why did the legislature put a cap on how much PPD awards get paid in lump sum? The reason they did that is the rationale that was expressed in our legislature in 1995 when they tried to eliminate the cap, and also in the treatises that talk about the statutory cap. And the reason for those caps is to ensure that the most seriously injured workers are compensated over time with installment payments and not left destitute after a lump sum payment is exhausted. That rationale was read into the legislative record right out of the Larson Treatise on this subject in 1995. Seriously injured workers often can't return to their pre-injury work or any work that would earn them equivalent income. And experience has taught that lump sum awards often are dissipated quickly once paid. The idea behind the cap is to make sure some portion of that PPD award is paid over time so that the injured worker is left with some income and not left destitute. So the theory is you cap how much can be paid in lump sum. Balance gets paid in installments over the lifetime of the claimant to compensate for that loss of earning capacity. The problem with the claimant's contention in this particular case is twofold. One, it ignores this concept that all permanent impairment is approached from a whole person perspective. And secondly, it conflicts with the rationale behind having a statutory cap. And I think an extreme example points this out. In this particular case, we had three separate PPD awards, one totaling 5%, one totaling 2%, one totaling 3%. But assume for the
33.
Assume we have a situation where an individual claimant has four separate PPD awards, each totaling 25%. If you take the claimant's approach to how you apply the statutory cap, each one of those PPDs would be paid in lump sum. Yet you have a claimant that's 100% disabled and no installment payments over the life of the claim. That's contrary to the rationale that was expressed by the legislature and underlies why we have statutory caps.
So I just want to understand, I think you've said this a couple times now, the idea that the claimant gets a limited amount as a lump sum and the rest paid out over time is somehow designed to benefit that claimant,
right,
not the person who's paying the lump sum.
Well, and actually the person paying the lump sum pays, if they pay the lump sum, for instance, the insurer paying the award, if they pay a lump sum, it's a present value of the installments paid over the lifetime of the claimant. So they actually pay less paying a lump sum than they do if they pay in installments.
Got it. Thank you.
Our position in this case is that once total impairment, including all disability awards, hits 25%, that cap kicks in. And from that point on, you get paid installments. You don't get additional lump sums for each PPD award.
But the statute doesn't say that.
Well, our position is the statute does say that. And the reason I say that, the argument on the other side of the case is that because the statute says a disability, that means any PPD award, you can pay up to 25%. But the point that I think is really fundamental here is that in our statutory scheme, the term disability equates to whole person impairment. It actually says that right in 616C.490. And so anytime you're talking about permanent partial disability or disability, what our statutory scheme is talking about is whole person impairment, not individual PPD awards. So when you read the statutory scheme, you have to keep in mind that what they're talking about is whole person impairment. And that concept is reflected repeatedly in our statutory scheme.
So the 33% impairment determination for this injury already went through that process and took that into account, right?
Well, that's what the insurer did. One of the complexities of this case is that when the PPD award, the 33% PPD award was calculated by the PPD physician, she wasn't aware that there were prior PPD awards. So the 33% in this case, and if you look at it closely, you'll see that it doesn't take into account the prior PPD awards.
So but this injury to her, I mean, her prior injuries were like a wrist and
right,
something else, and this is a spine.
Right.
Are you saying this 33% somehow double counts those prior injuries?
No. What happens under our statutory scheme is you're supposed to consider all impairments in calculating an impairment award at any given time. So when she had her spinal injury and had the impairment done, what was supposed to happen is that the physician is to basically calculate the whole impairment, including all prior awards, which in this case included the 2%, the 5%, and the 33%. And basically, you calculate the entire impairment, and then in this case, where the two prior impairments had been industrial insurance injuries, those had been already compensated. So you back out those, and what you pay is the difference for this particular injury.
Right.
The way those particular prior awards are calculated is under the combined values chart, which is in the AMA guides. Okay. So anytime a PPD is calculated, we have to do it according to the AMA guides by statute. Those guides make it very clear. Anytime you calculate a PPD, you take into account all prior impairment, so that anytime you have a PPD award, theoretically what you get is the whole person impairment, because that's what you're trying to compensate. You know, what is the loss of income over the life of the claimant caused by this whole person impairment? And so what you're trying to arrive at is just compensation to make up for this loss in earning capacity over the lifetime of the claimant. That's why you have to look at it from a whole person perspective every time you do the PPD evaluation. Then you just back out what's previously been paid.
Right, so the 33% has already backed that out, and the 33%...
No, it didn't in this case. What happened in this case is the physician that did the PPD award was not aware of the prior...
Okay.
So they didn't back it out. So what the insurer did, when they paid the 33% award, they deducted the two prior PPDs that were paid in lump sum. And so when they did that, totaled up, you know, that by their calculation, 7%. Okay, so they backed that out of 25, because 25 is as much as you can get, and determined that 18 would be paid in lump sum with the balance in installments. That's what the insurer did.
And what's the percentage balance? What's the percentage whole person impairment that they've calculated?
Well, what they did is they added the 2, the 5, and the 33, got 40
get
total.
Get to 40, and then they say...
Then they said, okay, the 2's been paid in lump sum, the 5's been paid in lump sum, so we're going to deduct that and then pay the difference up to 25.
Yeah, so they paid 18% as a lump sum, and they were going to pay 15% over time for the total of 33.
Right, exactly.
Okay, that's what I understand.
Let me just ask you this. I'm just struggling a little bit when looking at the NAC, reading it the way you're proposing, because it doesn't seem to limit. It doesn't seem to restrict. It's an employee who's injured who incurs a permanent partial disability. Where does that limit to each and every disability or injury that they may have?
I'm not sure I understand your question. If you say limit, what?
Oh, I'm sorry.
I think I understand what you're driving at. Is why don't you get 25% with each award, because it says a permanent partial disability? Comes back to the concept of whole person impairment. In our statutory scheme under 616C490, the term disability equates to whole person impairment.
But I guess my problem is it doesn't say that. It's not each and every injury.
It does say that in 616C490. It expressly says the term disability equates to whole person impairment.
But that's not about
whether you get a lump sum or a payout over time. That's about how you calculate the PPD percentage.
It is, but that's why I say it's important to understand how we calculate PPDs in order to understand why we have a statutory cap. And again, I come back to the example that if you have a number of substantial PPD awards, you have somebody who has substantial impairment in their earning capacity. Yet if you take the claimant's approach, there's no sum left over to pay over time. It all is paid in lump, and that is totally contrary to the whole point of having statutory caps. I mean, you theoretically could have somebody impaired almost to 100% and have received the entire amount in lump sum if you follow their rationale in this case. And that's the problem with it. You're supposed to be trying to make sure that that injured worker has some income over time because of this substantial impairment in their earning capacity over their life. And if we do it the way the claimant says, there's nothing left.
Can I ask you one more question?
Yes.
If you were done, were you done?
I am, thank you.
I think you're indicating the statute's somewhat ambiguous, or do you believe it's clear on its face as well?
Our position is...
You mentioned legislative history.
Right.
And can I finish the question?
Yeah.
Assuming it's ambiguous, and you look to the legislative history and the policy discussions, they're talking about the importance of having the ability to make these lump sum payments. Because if you have an employee who's been out of service for a significant period of time, this lets them catch up. So why wouldn't that apply to each and every injury? Suppose you were, it seems to apply equally as well.
I think the answer to that is...
to 125%.
I think the answer to that is you have to marry both concepts. Clearly, you know, a claimant that has a significant injury and been out of work for time is going to need some amount of money to kind of get back on track, get their lives back in order. But by the same token, if you have somebody that is very substantially injured and can't work the rest of their lives in a viable position, how do you make sure that person is compensated over time so they don't become a burden on society as opposed to a burden to the employers under the comp system? I mean, the comp system is set up to make sure employers pay for industrial injuries. It's not set up to make sure that society pays for industrial injuries. Employers are supposed to pay for it. One way you protect that injured worker and make sure they don't end up as a burden on society is by making sure these installment payments are available over the life of the claimant in order to make sure that they're not destitute.
Thank you.
Thank you. You've used up your rebuttal. You may approach.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Jason Guanasso, and I represent the respondent in this matter, Ms. Jody Uterbity. The issue that's really presented to this court is should this court substitute its judgment for the sound judgment of the appeal officer in a workers' compensation case when there is substantial evidence to support the appeal officer's decision? I don't think there's any dispute regarding the underlying facts, but I want to recite some of the important facts for you to consider. My client, Ms. Uterbity, worked for the City of Reno for approximately 20 years. Over the years, she sustained three separate injuries to three separate body parts as a result of three separate work-related accidents. Each of these three injuries resulted in a separate permanent partial disability rating for each body part. Those injuries occurred. First one was to the right wrist, and a disability award was provided in the for 5% as a result of disability to her right wrist. A couple of years later, she had injured her left elbow, and in April of 2013, she received a 2% disability rating. And then finally, in 2015, she had injured her cervical spine, and in 2016, she received a disability award of 33% for her cervical spine injury. Now, the appellant issued the determination that's at issue here today, basically apportioning these prior work-related injuries out of her original, out of her 33% PPD award. And that sort of apportionment is not permissible in this case. Apportionment typically and by statute occurs when you have an injury to the same body part. So if we had a prior injury to the cervical spine that resulted in a 5% disability, then a subsequent PPD rating would result in an apportionment of that 5% off the total amount. So in this case...
How do you get that out of the statute? That it matters. I mean, I understand your friend on the other side's point that you can't have a whole body injury that's more than 100%. And so whether it's the same body part or a different one, they're assessing percentage of whole body disability. And so I don't see in the statute the linkage to the same body part versus different body parts against the whole person disability. And if you could walk me through the statute that supports that in your analysis, that would help me.
Thank you, Your Honor. Well, let's go to the statute. Let's start with NRS 616C495 subsection 1, Part D, where it says, any claimant injured on or after July 1st, 1995 may elect to receive his or her compensation in lump sum in accordance with the regulations adopted by the administrator and approved by the governor. So the administrator, that is the Department of Administration, adopted NAC 616C498. This regulation specifically provides an employee injured on or after July 1st, 1995 who incurs a permanent partial disability that does not exceed 25% may elect to receive compensation in lump sum, or then it says exceeds 25% may elect to receive compensation in lump sum equal to the present value of of an award for a disability of 25%. So the statutory, both the regulatory language here that was adopted contemplates a single accident, a single injury, and a single disability, and gives the claimant the discretion in those instances to elect to receive their compensation in lump sum up to 25% for each disability. My colleague, Mr. Rose, the appellant's position with regard to having four different disabilities, each for 25% each, is a red herring. And the reason why
But I'm not getting even separate injuries to the same body part separated over time. Why aren't those, in your reading, each their own permanent partial disability? I mean, my left wrist is injured. It sort of heals, but I got a 2% award. I re-injure it, and it's worse, so it's a 15%. Why is that separate? But left, right, a left wrist and a right wrist aren't. I'm just confused about the wording of the statute and why you're drawing the line at the same body part versus a different body part.
Because the way that compensation is awarded is tied to an injury by accident arising out of and in the course of employment, NRS 616-150. And so when determining compensation for a permanent partial disability, we start with the fact
that... But it's a partial of the whole body. It's not partial of my right wrist.
It is of the whole body. That's true. So you have a whole... You're evaluating a disability with respect to the whole person. Now, if this were a case where my client had one accident that resulted in three different injuries, then the whole person impairment analysis that was provided to you by Mr. Rowe would be applicable in this case, because what's required in those cases when we're dealing with one accident resulting in multiple injuries is a mandate to go to the combined values chart, take each of those disability ratings, and then make sure that you are coming up with a rating that's a disability of the whole person relative to the three injuries that arise out of the same accident. But when in this case, when you have different accidents that occur to different body parts as a result of as a result of different transactions and occurrences that resulted in that accident. In this case, we have 2009, 2013, 2016. Neither the statutes or the regulations contemplate limiting...
it's really not body part. You're saying it's the event or the accident.
The accident that results in the injury to the body part then determines what compensation is due to the claimant in any given case.
The 33% impairment determination from this event, already the 33% number as an impairment to the whole body already takes into account the prior injuries and prior impairments she had. Isn't that right?
In this situation, they would not have taken it into account because those other events were separate injuries and separate accidents, and they wouldn't have been apportioned, and there wouldn't have been an application of the combined values chart in that situation because the guides, the fifth edition of the Guides of Permanent Impairment only contemplates combining the values of three different or multiple injuries when those injuries arise out of a single accident.
But, and I'm sorry, I'm not being clear, but the 33% determination, the PPD determination for this accident is a 33% whole body impairment, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And, but that is the amount attributed to this event.
Yes, Your Honor.
So the prior 7% impairment she had from two prior injuries are not like part of the 33%.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Okay.
That's correct. And so going to appellant's example to you, if you had four different PPDs, all of which were 25% or more, the reason why that's a red herring is because you have to take into account other sorts of benefits that come into a play when a person is permanently and totally disabled. So if a person got a third injury and in total they had a combined amount of, let's say, 75% permanent impairment, you know, amputated arm, paralyzed left arm, and a back injury, that person's not going to be able to be gainfully employed and providing a permanent partial disability rating would be inappropriate under the statutes in that regard. And so their benefit wouldn't be another PPD award. If that were the case in my client's situation, we wouldn't be asking for another PPD award. We would be looking to avail her of the benefits under the PTD statute. And so the situation that appellant has presented to you does not occur, cannot occur, and will not occur.
Right, that would be a total disability.
That's right.
I want to return to my point for a minute, though. Under the Eads case, you had two separate accidents, correct, injuring the same body part?
No, Your Honor. No.
Okay. What were the facts?
So in the Eads case, what you had is a reopening case.
Okay.
And in a reopening case, you have a worsening of a condition. And so in that case, there was an injury where there was medical treatment and care provided that resulted in a disability rating. Then subsequent to the closure of the case, that individual had a worsening of the condition that required reopening of the same claim. And so technically what the IDES was getting was a modification of the original disability award that they had received when the claim was originally opened. And so that case is a reopening case. It's not a multiple injury case. And that's why it's distinguishable and really not applicable in this case. And further, when you look at the legislative history, and I know appellants have invited that, you're not going to find anything helpful to reach a decision, Your Honors, because the legislative history only contemplates what we've been discussing, and that is an injury caused by an accident arising out of and in the course of employment, and what benefits are due as a result. You're not going to find anywhere in the legislative history where there's a discussion of multiple injuries that occur over multiple years and result in separate disability awards. You're just not going to find that. And so I don't think you can infer legislative intent in order to modify the plain language of both the statute and the regulation to fit the theory of the case that have appellants that have presented to you. Construction would really be effectively lawmaking on the court's behalf, and I know that this court is loath to take the position of the legislature and rewrite the law to fit a certain set of facts or circumstances. Even if you didn't like the result, this court has had a long history of deferring to the legislature to fix statutory infirmities. But in this situation, there's really no harm to the appellant relative to providing a lump sum payment to my client for this unique and separate accident and injury. And really, there's harm to clients like mine who have a subsequent injury and can't avail themselves of the full lump sum amount at the time of that accident and injury.
Say to Mr. Rowe's point that your position, if credited, could result in an injured worker receiving, who has four injuries, each 25%, receiving each in a lump sum, and then being left destitute in the future, and that that is inconsistent with workers' compensation concepts that would afford some protection into the future, because people get lump sums and they tend to squander them, whereas if they get something over time each month, they tend not to. I mean, that's the reasoning, I think.
Yes, Your Honor, thank you for the question. The first, that fact scenario can never happen because a different set of benefits kick in, and that is the permanent and total disability benefits. And so if you had a set of successive disabilities that were 25% or greater, the benefit would not be a permanent partial disability rating. It would be permanent total disability, which would entitle the
claimant. Let's do two 50%, two 25% ones.
So two 25% awards would not leave the claimant destitute relative to their ability to avail themselves of the lump sum. There's no evidence of the record of that, either in this record or the legislative record. And really, the workers' comp statutes were not meant to usurp the discretion of the injured worker with regard to how they want to elect to receive their benefits. And that's reflected in the plain language of the statute that's before you, as well as in the regulation. I see my time is up. It was an honor to present to you today. It's my first time before you, and I thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you so much. And I really appreciate both the briefs and the arguments in this case. It's an interesting issue, and everybody did a good job on it. And we appreciate the amicus brief as well.
Thank you very much.
We'll be in recess, and this matter will be submitted. Thank you. All rise.